interesting. In the light of special education, I wanted to introduce a tool that you might not really think of as a tool for special education because it's such a general tool that we use for everything. And that tool is the use of digital books. And you've probably seen a digital book. Many of you had the opportunity when we did the learning centers to see the living books. I think we had, it was Arthur's Haunted House. Does that sound familiar to anyone? When we did the learning centers going around. Okay, so that was an example of a digital book. There are also digital books available online. So I want to show you the types of things that are available. So when you think about the case study that we did at the beginning of class, maybe one option is to be able to get her the audio of that book. But maybe if that book isn't available in audio, maybe there are other things that we can do as well to assist that student. First of all, digital books just means that it's a book that's available in digital format. And when I think of digital books, I tend to think textually, digitally, but what we're finding more and more is you can get a book in audio format, and that's also a digital format. So for instance, when I listen to books now, what I tend to do is I go to audible.com and I download whatever book I want. They have tons of books in Audible. It's like the old version of recorded books. I can now get, instead of recorded books, getting them on CD, I just download them to my computer. You can also, I think, get audiobooks in iTunes. Has any of you done that? I haven't done that. And you can even get some audiobooks through the public library system and through UNLV's library system. So there's a lot that's available. You just have to go and look for it. But today we're going to focus on the textual aspects of it. One thing that I want you to keep in mind is that when we think of reading a digital book, we tend to think of looking at it on a screen, or maybe for me it might be reading it on my little handheld. And honestly, for me, that's very, very difficult on my eyes. And getting older, I'm already starting to wear glasses when I'm working on the computer, and it's small, and it's not as easy and as comfortable as just throwing a book in my bag or in my purse or having it in the car. So why would I even want to use this different method? And the reason that I would tend to be interested in using this isn't because it just gives me access, which I can quickly get access to something that I wouldn't otherwise have, but it allows me to go from simply reading the book to actually studying the book. You can, when you're reading a textbook, you can write in the margins and underline things, but you're kind of limited because of the static way that a textbook or any other book is presented to you. What if you could do anything you wanted? You could tear pages out, put pages next to each other in different orders. You can put things in different order. You could add pictures in here. You could write your notes in the column. You could put little parentheses inside the text. And that's stuff that you can do when you have the flexibility of a digital text as opposed to the static page. What I'm going to do is I have some quotes that I would like to have two of you read. So let's see. Emily, will you read one? And just read it loudly, please. And will you read the other one? Go ahead. Will you read this later in the time?
He wanted to read Freud. Oh. That had been his mistake. Freud had been studied, not read. He had to be studied like a page of, I don't know these guys' names. Talmud?
The Talmud.
And he had to be studied with a commentary. But Danny didn't know of any commentaries on Freud, so he had settled for the next best thing. He needed something that would explain Freud's technical terminology, that would clarify the various shades of meaning the German words had, and he had found this dictionary of psychological terms. He was reading Freud now, sentence by sentence. He didn't go on to the next sentence until the prior sentence was perfectly clear to him in his mind. If he came across a German word he didn't know, he looked up its English meaning in the castles. If the castles gave him a translation he didn't understand, one that wouldn't fit the meaning of the sentence, he looked up the English word in a psychology dictionary. That psychological dictionary was his commentary.
Okay. So what does this make you think? What's this guy doing? He's studying. It sounds like what you guys do on a regular basis, right? Now, there are some classes where you can just read the text, and I'd hope that our class is one of those where it's not very complicated. But if you're taking something like political theory and you're reading Plato, it's very possible that you need to, every single word, you're looking it up or you're trying to find out a context for it. Or if you're reading maybe a physics textbook, that you don't know what a lot of stuff is, so you're using lots of different textbooks. For this guy, he's flipping through lots of different resources. Would it be easier if those resources were right at his fingertips? If he could just click on a word and the definition would pop up. Or if he could click on another word that was maybe written in German, he could hear it spoken in German and then spoken in English, so he would know what it is. And that is the capability that we can get with digital text. Okay, so Amanda's going to read a second one for us.
I found the reading difficult. The sentences were packed with Latin and Greek terms. Dictionaries were no help. I was ready to give up when wild chance put an end to my troubles. I stopped one day to browse in a tray of secondhand books. I picked up a slender novel volume. It was a German dictionary of botanical terms. It was thorough and never failed me. It gave me the meanings of etymology of each term. In addition, there were thumbnail biographies of outstanding botanists and a description of a famous botanical institute. I became attached to the booklet. I cherished it as I would a magic oracle that knows all the answers.
Now what? Thank you. What tends to be our magic oracle today? What knows all the answers, it seems? The internet. Okay. Now what if as you're reading, you've got that right there? Now you might sit and read your physics textbook or, you know, Plato or Aristotle with the internet right there. But wouldn't it be nice if automatically, if I clicked on something and it said, and then Bonhoeffer said, and it clicked on Bonhoeffer, you could see who is Bonhoeffer, when did he live, and why is it important what he said? Wouldn't it be nice if that were already embedded in the text? And that's what digital books allow you to do. What these are quotes from 1983, Eric Hoffer in Truth Imagined, and from The Chosen by Potok. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce it. And so these are typically what authors will do, researchers will do. They need to see those interconnections. And digital book allows us to make those interconnections. In the past, they had to find all these different resources. We don't have to do the type of searching that they had to do. We have it at our fingertips, but wouldn't it be nice if it was just right there and you didn't even have to do a search for each thing? Well, the truth is that it's not all that difficult because now we do have archives of books online. The way that it works, if you'll recall back when we did the digital copyright issues, one of the things that I told you then is that a book enters the, or a writing, enters the public domain after 75 years if no one maintains copyright rights for it. So, for instance, if I published a book in 1925, and then I died in 1926, and I didn't pass on the rights to that book, then what'll eventually happen is by 2000, that book, well, 2001, that book is going to be in the public domain. What it used to be is that meant in the public domain, anybody could get access rights to it, you didn't have to really pay to get it. Well, what some very intelligent people decided to do was, well, if nobody has the rights to those, why don't we make them available for everybody? And the way that they decided to make them available for everybody was by scanning all that text and putting it online. So great classics like Shakespearean sonnets or Mark Twain stuff or the Bible, all of this stuff actually can be online because it's in the public domain. One of the greatest places to go and find, which is always my first place to search for digital books, is the Gutenberg, Project Gutenberg. And as you know, the Gutenberg Press was the forerunner. The Gutenberg Press is truly a phenomenal creation because for the first time, information could be shared and disseminated without the use of your voice. So So if I didn't have to actually sit and have a Socratic dialogue with Socrates or with Plato, what I could do is I could read what he wrote or what he might have said in a different location and never even be in the same city in which that person was. And I would be reading his exact words. I wouldn't be reading words that somebody had said that he said. So I was getting the real thing. So this was very exciting. And it's exciting now, too, with the internet, because we have that same incredible resource where we can get those words that somebody said. Now, of course, on the internet, I can read what you all wrote. I can read what my, you know, sons write if they put it online. I can read what anybody wrote. And, you know, who really cares what a lot of people write? But there are some things that we do care a lot about what they write because there are a lot of great classics out there. So if you go to Project Gutenberg and you do a search, you'll find books like this one. This is the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tales, or fairy tales? Their stories are all in the public domain, and many of them, if not all of them, have been placed in Gutenberg. And so what it looks like is if I just do a search for Hans Christian Andersen, then I'll find his options, and if I click on Little Match Girl, here will be the story of the Little Match Girl. What's neat, though, is it also includes an audio version.
Hello, I am Felicia Sabad, and I will be reading The Little Match Girl, a story by Hans Christian Andersen. Most terribly cold it was. It snowed and was nearly quite dark, an evening, the last evening of the year. In this cold and darkness there went along the street a poor little girl, bareheaded and with naked feet. When she left home, she had slippers on, it is true, but what was the good of that? They were very large slippers, which her mother had hitherto worn. So large were they, and the poor little thing lost them as she scuffled away across the street because of two carriages that rolled by dreadfully fast.
Okay. So what might be the benefit of hearing that audio? Okay, excellent. So if you can't read it, you can figure out what it is by listening to it. What else? Okay, Kaylee? Excellent. Great. Okay, excellent. Okay, Kayla?
As far as like some of the punctuation, even like in that first sentence, people may not know how like the pauses go, how exactly you read that.
Okay, so, and that actually is an issue of fluency. Okay, all right, and somebody else had one over here?
I was going to say, the vivid picture, you could see that, you know, it helps with comprehension. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so comprehension, and especially for if you have a student who has a reading disability, when they're reading this, every single word might be difficult to read, but if they can just hear it, then they can really start to understand the story. Also, with the issue that Kayla said, the issue of fluency, when you read a story like this, it doesn't make the same emotional impression than one that is stated in more fluent language. Emily, did you have a
pronunciation for certain words?
Great, okay. And you know that you say that. English is your second language, and so that's really neat, especially too for ESL students who might have read words, but they don't really know how to pronounce them. I've learned to really respect people that mispronounce words, because usually what that means is that they're extremely well read, and they've just never heard it spoken, that word, and so they're using a word that they've read. And this is a great way to get individuals to be able to pronunciate those words that they haven't read before or heard before. One problem with some of these audios in the Gutenberg Press or in Project Gutenberg is that many of them don't sound like this. They're not using human speech. Instead, what they use is computer-generated speech. And we'll talk about computer-generated speech later in the semester when we do issues of the future. And computer-generated speech still kind of sounds, it's a lot better. You heard it the other day when we did the computer said stuff, but pretty much it's back in that do you want to play a game type stuff. And it's good. It can recognize punctuation and pronounce most things, but it still sounds computer generated. There are other digital book repositories available online. And here's one from online books, library, upenn.edu. And this one I like because of the way that they show their books. So in this case, I'm showing you screenshots. I did a search for Mark Twain, and I saw the two greats, Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. And when I go to those, you'll see on the left, here's Tom Sawyer, and I can jump anywhere I want to in that book. You can see I just click on the chapter that I want. I can scroll up and down really quickly. On the left-hand side, it has a kind of a different look for Huckleberry Finn, but what I like is that they've also scanned in the pictures. I've been listening on a podcast in NPR, and they were talking about how they are working very, very quickly around the world to try and scan as much as they can. Having books that we don't have access to, maybe they're hidden in a cellar in some library somewhere, it's a big thing to be able to give us access to those. And there's a huge push right now to get as much access as possible. And so we're literally mailing books in groves to Eastern Asia, where there's inexpensive labor currently, and they're scanning as quickly as they can, and the books are being sent back. So that's one way that this is happening. Whether that's appropriate labor, that's a personal political issue.
Are these websites listed on our outline for today?
I'm not sure. Look on the lesson plan and see if they are. I'm not sure. Okay, I don't think that they are. One thing is that when you go in and you download the books, what we've seen is what they look like when you download them, and they might look a little bit like this. And one problem that you're going to have is that students might not be able to read them very well like this. So one way to get around that is to say, I'm going to copy that text and I'm going to paste it in. I'm going to make it bigger. Maybe I have a student who is visually impaired, can read just fine, but needs it bigger. Well, why not print it bigger or put it bigger on the screen? Maybe I have a student who is colorblind, or that wouldn't be a real issue. Maybe they have a problem with different color contrasts. So if it's a white on a black, that's difficult, or black on a white, that's difficult for them to read. Usually those types of issues are more the red and greens for colorblind, but there are people who have issues with that. Maybe what I can do is I can go through and I can find the difficult words. Here's one. Whenever I have a word that is really big, I can go through as a teacher and I can change that word. I can take out the word elaborate and maybe say make prettier, you know, make it something that the student can read instead. So I could really do what, who was this talking about, differentiated instruction, Laura? I can really differentiate the instruction now. All of my students can read that same story, but I've gone through and I've made it look different, or I put different words in different places so that everyone can understand it at their level. Now that's very, very time consuming, but if you're using the same reading material over a long period of time, you know, over a career, over 20 years, and you use that same book, it could be worth that time, especially if you have all the grade level teachers at your school are using the same book and you can go in and make some changes. Also on some other things that you can do to make it, instead of just reading and creating more a study environment, is recognizing that there's a reason why in your textbooks there's a big white space on the side, and that's so you can write in it. But often when you read novels, let's say you're reading Charlotte's Web or the book Johnny Tremaine that we talked about at the beginning of class, there's usually not a lot of room to write in the margins, even though we want our students to be critically thinking about it. So if you print out the text and you can create margins as big as you want, you could create it so that you can do two column Carnegie notes or whatever type of notes you want. You can also go in, and once it's in Word and it's text and it's in digital format, you can add in footnotes, you can add in endnotes, you can add in anything that you want. You can manipulate it, you can copy and paste whatever you want. Also, you can add your own graphics. So let's say that you want a student to illustrate a picture from Charlotte's Web. Well then, what would it look on a farm? And so they go in and they illustrate it. Maybe they'll put a picture right. That will be the chapter start for their Charlotte's Web. Those can be student made, or you can say, I want you to go online and find pictures that illustrate, like I had my students read Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe, historically Africa history. Africa history. And in that book, I could have my students go out and actually find pictures from the geographic regions that they're talking about. Or imagine if you're reading something something about the Congo so that they could really get an appreciation of what that section looks like and actually embed that into the text using Word or some other option. Okay, next I'm going to have Kaylee is going to read another audio about audios.
On a text that otherwise wouldn't have been available to him. He read Maniac McGee. I look forward to the time when the e-reader will be available to all students who need it.
So e-reader is a program, thank you, that will read the text for you. And I'll be introducing you to other types of programs like Kurzweil's reader. I'm not sure what it's officially called, but it's by Ray Kurzweil. Kurzweil 3000, that will do the same type of thing later in the semester. Again, they don't sound really great, but for some students, if they can't read it on their own, it's really kind of a learned thing to be able to hear and read books or to understand the audio that has that more digitized speech. And so this is one tool that this one teacher found was extremely, not only beneficial, but essential for this child's learning. Have any of you been to the UK or to Australia and listened to people talking? Okay, I lived in London for a year, and so when you go to a new country, even if you know the language, it's the same language, it takes kind of a while to get used to hearing that speech. And for a while, you're just listening to the cadence of the language. You're listening to the rhythms that they're using and the different accents that they're using. But over time, you get used to that. And from what I've heard, not that I've gone through that experience, that it's the same with listening to digital speech. If you listen to it over and over and over again, it's just like listening to somebody from the South speaking. Eventually, you don't have so many troubles understanding it. Or maybe thinking, I'm thinking like in Jamaica. It's very difficult to understand people when I went to Jamaica because of the cadence that they use. And so you can learn and adapt to that, but it's through a learning experience. Okay, so some things that you can do with digital books, and we pretty much mentioned these. One idea is the idea of cloning and mutating, and these slides really come from one of my colleagues named Mark Horney, who's an expert in this area of digital books, and that's he termed that cloning and mutating books. And he says you can delete sections of books. Maybe if a student can't read that much text, what you can do is take out part of it, take out the part, make it the Reader's Digest version of the book for that child. You can go in and highlight it. I don't know if you've ever use that tool or not in Word, but you can highlight over words and it looks like you've used the highlighter and put it in yellow. You can highlight in whatever color that you want. You can do any colors at all with the text and the other. You can repaginate. Maybe you say, I want you to read between this page and this page, but everybody's reading between this page and this page, but those aren't the same pages or the same text for every student. Okay. Next, features for learning, and this starts to get for your older grades. One thing is semantic feature analysis, and that's the idea that you can have students go through and do very specific studies on books, like how many times did they use this word in the text, and go in and have them do a search and find it and figure out what are the statistics that go around with it. We tend to see this like with use, he was talking about study of the Talmud. So of religious scriptures, we often see this type of semantic analysis. But it also is kind of fun for students to do, to start to say, how many times was the main character's name mentioned? Or how many times was a secondary character's name mentioned? And then just thinking of books, not so much as something that you just read, as something that is an actual learning tool. And this gives you the benefit of doing that. Some examples of how you use books as learning tools. These are almost, I think they're all from the Center for Advanced Technology and Education at the University of Oregon, where Mark is, and they're just phenomenal, and they're made for children. What they've done is they've taken the diary of Opal Whiteley, a little girl, a little historical figure, kind of think of it like Anne Frank's diary, and they put it all online. But notice all of these underlined, these are all links to more information. So if I click on a link that says it's something about my school, then I'll see this picture. And this is an actual picture of Opal Whiteley, and there she is. And how would you like your classroom to look like that? That's a lot. And you've got to teach them all subjects all day long. Yeah, okay. All right, here's another one. This one is not from Center for Advanced Technology and Education. It's the International Children's Digital Library. You can go in and look up books in this section, but what's neat here is they have this spiral opportunity to look at different pages, and they're scanned pages, so you actually see what it looks like on the book. But you can say, I remember that back on this page, and you can click, and this one will then come to the front. And it shows you the order, but you can change which one's in the front. So it's a great opportunity for studying. This one is also from that same place. What it does is it takes the Canterbury Tales in, you've got the language that it was written in, so you can read it, but then you also have the flowery script that it was written in. So you can see what did it really look like to have students seeing primary documents. Or this one where it takes the Cook's Prologue and it has the sentence, and then it has the sentence instead of in Old English in a version that hopefully will be easier for students to be able to read and understand. This one, On the Run, again from Oregon. This one I really like it all a lot. It was designed to be used by students who were at risk. I believe that most of the students had some type of a disability, but they also were the types of students who had a past with juvenile delinquency, if I remember correctly. And what it does, let's say you click on this word here and it says intake area. Then what it does is it pops up with a definition. A place where information is gathered before entering into a jail or a hospital. Or right over here it has a think link and it says, have you ever had to go to a new or frightening place? And instead of just putting it there for a student to ignore, if you click on it, what'll happen is you get a place where you can actually write the information out. And then you save it, and that information can go to your teacher, or it could maybe go to a public space where you can read and respond to each other's comments. So some of those resources that are available are translational. It translates for you. So maybe what they've done up in Oregon is, maybe if it's a child who cannot hear very well, maybe it'd be easier for them if they saw the ASL signs. And so they actually have a little video. If you click on something, it describes it using ASL instead of the words. Illustrative, it might explain, or back with translational, if you have a high Spanish speaking population, you might be able to click on words and what'll happen is it'll read the word in Spanish for you or come up with the Spanish translation. Illustrative, means that it gives you more information. So if I am describing Opal Whiteley's classroom, it's very illustrative to show a picture of Opal Whiteley's classroom. So that would be a good example. Or if I'm talking about Nigeria, like we were before, and I show you a map of Nigeria or some pictures from that. If I'm talking about the different hairstyles, showing you that picture, that would be an example of illustrative. And usually these are toggling on and off. I can make it show or not make it show, because often too much information is simply too much information. So you want it so that students can access it, but they don't have to access it. Instructional, maybe it tells you more. Maybe it says, you need to complete this by using the formula for area. And if you don't know the formula for area, maybe you can click on formula for area and it tells you what the formula is. Collaborative, and that's like where I said that you could type in that section and then it'll go to your teacher and your teacher could communicate back to you, or maybe it'll go to a peer or a group of peers and you can do collaboration. And then finally, summarizing, especially for students with learning disabilities, it's critical that after we present information, we go back and we review it. And that's why in good instructional design, you review your objectives and you review your outline at the end of every class period. So you're doing that summarizing process. And so that's something that also is very easy to create in a digital book format. Some digital books that you might enjoy looking into that are good for elementary. Living Books, which is actually a software company, and we have a lot of Living Books downstairs. And they're just kind of fun, especially for your preschool and your early readers, like your lower readers in kindergarten and first. Mighty Book is another really good one that's available online. It used to not be a pay subscription, but I think it might, you might have to pay for it now. And then DEANSA is the one that's out of the Center for Advanced Technology and Education. And that takes the diaries and the history of Juan Bautista DEANSA, I think that's his name, who came up from Mexico all the way up to San Francisco and pretty much settled all of California and all of the churches that are along the way, and it's all the Mexican history of that era. And it's just all of the diaries that he has, but also links to pictures and links to maps so that you can really understand what that means. Okay, any comments or questions about digital books?